I'm Christopher Lydon, with a star of the rising generation of American letters, Damien Searles. We're rediscovering a giant in the journals of Henry David Thoreau, nature, moral politics, and American prose at a pinnacle for all time. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is a young writer's case for a classic. Damien Searles writes stories, lyric essays, and translations. But then, after our conversation with David Shields drove us back to the pure essay in American English, I quickly found my way to Thoreau's Endless Journal, re-edited by the same busy man, Damien Searles. So here we are with Thoreau, a specimen of American genius, spontaneous and unmixed, one of his contemporaries said. Thoreau left 7,000 pages of day-to-day jottings from college days in the late 1830s, nearly to his death in the spring of 1862, Civil War time. Damien Searles, you've remastered this journal, and you've brought something back to life, something wonderful. How do you describe it, first off, this tome, this odd masterpiece?
The thing about it that surprises me still, after having lived with it for a while, is that it's not a journal like other writers' journals. It's not a sort of notebook or copybook or testing ground. It really is a project of its own. That's why I sort of fought with the publisher a bit to call it the journal instead of the journals. It's not his notebooks. It's his exploration of what a day means, what a season means, what the rhythms of nature around him and his life have to do with each other. So it's really this very specific synthesizing project where he observes everything. There's the frogs, there's the neighbors, there's his own moods, there's the Civil War, there's John Brown, there's everything else. But the reason he's doing it isn't just to collect facts. It's because the richer his collection of facts is, the more material he has to synthesize and create these beautiful connections and metaphors and spiritual leaps that make Thoreau so fantastic.
It's an interesting point. It does read like a single inquiry about life. It's not gossip. It has few personal observations and sketches in it. It does have drawings, which is interesting, of natural phenomena. It's not just clippings. It's a steady inquiry about the spirit, about his own self, about psychology, very little politics, amazingly, but it is a tome.
Well, that's what I wanted to do with this book. There have been selections before, but what the selections have tended to do is either treat the journal as sort of a quarry where you could take out little pieces of important biographical or historical or cultural information, or even with his writing, they've kind of done the same thing and snipped out a great sentence without the 10-page entry that the sentence comes from and arises out of. I mean, every day, the guy wrote 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 pages, day after day after day. That's about 100, 150 pages a month. And so what I wanted to do was give readers who aren't going to read the 7,000 pages a way to feel what the journal is like as a book, as a project, as a literary mode. And so the way I kind of joked about it is that I leave the boring bits in because, it's, first of all, they're not boring. And secondly, it's in the context of his seemingly random notations that he's gathering the materials to make these leaps. I probably shouldn't call them the boring bits. I should probably call them the texture.
So much to touch on here. So many famous lines about the bluebird carrying the sky on its back, that sort of thing. So much stuff about solitude and self, about the spirit of the universe, which he thought was unaccountably kind to him. I want to get to the question of why suddenly it feels so 21st century, so us, in form, in spirit, in energy, maybe in darkness too. I want to get to the abolitionist, the naturalist, of course, and then the writer. But first, would you just sketch this man himself?
Sure. So he was born in 1817, same generation as all the sort of younger American Renaissance folks, Melville, that crowd. Hawthorne was older. Emerson, of course, much older. Yeah, so he was from a family of four. His beloved older brother, John, was the darling of the family. The great loss of Thoreau's life probably was when his older brother died of lockjaw in his arms after cutting himself with a razor. That hit Thoreau so hard that he had psychosomatic lockjaw symptoms that made his family fear for his life. But then he recovered and sort of transformed what was going to be his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, into a kind of tribute of this trip he had taken with his brother John. He, as you say, I think thinking of him as a Yankee is a great way to think of him. You can also think of him as kind of an engineer type. He did have jobs. The two main ones were working for and eventually playing a much bigger part in the family business, which was pencil manufacturing. He figured out how to make what we know of as lead pencils. And in fact, the Thoreau pencils were the highest quality you could get in America. He's famous for being able to reach his hand into a vat and pull out a dozen pencils in his hand without counting them. He had bodily knowledge of things. His other main job that he had to do a lot more of after his first book was a financial failure was surveying. So he, as Emerson said in his eulogy for Thoreau, could pace 16 yards better than most other people could measure it with a chain. What was much more important to him than making a good living was living a good life. And so he would go out and take these walks every day. The more he walked, the more he wrote.
Emerson said you could wake him at any moment of the year and he could tell you within a day or two what day it was.
I love that. I love thinking of that. So his first book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, is, of course, organized around a week. Walden is organized around a year. Even though he was there for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days, the book itself is structured as a one-year sojourn in the woods. And then what he was probably going to do at the end of his life was use all of these data points that he was gathering in his journal to make what he sometimes called a calendar of Concord. In other words, integrating with this very ecological mindset all the different systems of when the weather changes, when this or that flower blooms, when this or that animal starts to come back and, you know, eat this or that plant. But he definitely has this kind of no-nonsense Yankee bluntness about him. But underneath it, there really is a lot of warmth that you can see not only in his writing, but in his life as well.
I come to him often from the Emerson view. He described him as a compact little guy, 5'7", I think 127 pounds, Thoreau says himself, which makes him a featherweight in boxing. But he had strong, serious, icy blue, Emerson called them terrible eyes, a firm build, light complexion, sort of a grave aspect. But he said Henry Thoreau seemed stubborn and implacable, always manly and wise, but rarely sweet.
That seems fair. There is sweetness, though. I mean, that's one reason I told the story of his brother. And he does have this kind of goofy, he'll dance jigs on the ice or go into raptures when he hears the wind blowing in the telephone wires. He thought that that should be the 10th muse. He kept calling it an Aeolian harp or a wind harp. So he does have this very kind of playful side that usually comes out when he's by himself, and then he'll occasionally write about it. So he certainly would not go to a cocktail party and charm everyone else there. But I think that Emerson's take on him is a little harsh.
Damien, there is this thread of solitude. He says, I thrive on solitude. Your edition of the journal begins with these extraordinary epigraphs from other writers, poets, about solitude. Maybe the starkest one, but I love it, is just two short lines from Andrew Marvel. Two paradises are in one to live in paradise alone. One thing to be in Concord and happy, but oh, to be happy in that place alone. What is this all about?
I think partly that's about being young. He's only in his 20s when he goes off to live in Walden Pond for a couple years. And in the later years, sure, he still goes for a lot of walks alone and is not ever married and not known to have any relationships and things like that. But he is quite sociable with the people he feels are worth his time and with his family and things like that. And also, by that point, is enough connected with nature that it really is social for him to be out in the woods. So it's solitary in a sense, and he'll emphasize that, especially in the early years when, you know, he's disappointed that he can't find his true soulmate. But he doesn't really feel solitary by the time he's in his late 30s or 40s. He even talks about proposing marriage to a scrub oak and things like that.
Get into the naturalist. I mean, this is maybe the most famous Thoreau, the father of environmental awareness and that sort of thing. It's strange to be talking about it at a moment when BP oil wells are just gushing raw petroleum into the Gulf of Mexico. But take us back to that guy who thought he might, in fact, be a fish. He wanted to be. He said, I fancy I am amphibious and swim in all the brooks and pools in the neighborhood with the perch and the bream.
Let's see. I mean, there are a couple things to say there. The first is that he was living in a time of environmental disaster that, of course, seems pretty good now compared to where we're at. But there was tons of deforestation going on in the Industrial Revolution at the time. In fact, there are less trees around Walden Pond when he was there than there are now. It's been brought back to some extent. He talks about seeing a piece of driftwood in the river and knowing where it came from because all the other trees of that species had been cut down. And he says, oh, it's come to this, that you see a tree and you know where it's from because there's only one of them. He, at one point, says, you know, they're cutting down all the trees. At least they can't cut down the clouds and pollute the sky, which, of course, they now can. And so it is important, I think, not to see Thoreau as being like an easy environmentalist. Like, sure, anyone can love nature when it's not being destroyed, as opposed to now. Well, it was being destroyed then, too, certainly from his point of view. The other thing I wanted to say about him being a fish or identifying with the frogs or whatever is that that's, I think, the lasting and important insight that Thoreau really has about nature. The way that, you know, Freud was wrong about a lot of things, but sort of got this main thing very right about the way unconscious parts of ourselves play out in our lives. I think the thing that Thoreau got really right is this kind of systemic understanding of nature, of everything. His word for this was economy. Our word for it is ecology, where, I mean, he was the one who figured out that animals carry seeds. And so the way new forests spring up isn't just by spontaneous generation, but because the seeds have been specifically carried there and planted by the animals. And he has this very great way of, you could say anthropomorphizing, but you could also say animating everything in nature. He says, yeah, you know, some people might say the squirrel just does it on instinct, but who are we to say that the squirrel doesn't have a slight thought of posterity? And, you know, is planting the tree there for the same reasons that we would try and keep a forest going. So I thought I might read one passage that gets to this. He's 36 years old. This is May 17th, 1854. Observed a rill emptying in above the stone heaps and afterwards saw where it ran out of Juneberry Meadow. And I considered how surely it would have conducted me to the meadow if I had traced it up. I was impressed, as it were, by the intelligence of the brook, which for ages in the wildest regions before science is born knows so well the level of the ground and through whatever woods or other obstacles finds its way. Who shall distinguish between the law by which a brook finds its river, the instinct by which a bird performs its migrations, and the knowledge by which a man steers his ship around the globe? Mm. The globe is the richer for the variety of its inhabitants. So he really very deeply not only feels like he's a fish, but feels that sort of everything's in the same boat when it comes to interacting with its surroundings. He calls the fish his finny contemporaries. So it's not just that he's a fish. It's that he and the fish are sort of, they're playing the same game. You know, they're in the same environment and they're doing what they do for, who's to say, not the same reasons. And I think that that's what makes his writing so alive. At one point, he says, if you really care about something, you'll use the personal pronouns to describe it. And that's what is so rich about all his nature descriptions, because he's really bringing all these things to life because he sees them as alive.
Can I come back at you with his description of frogs?
Yeah, I love that.
April 18th, 1858. He's 40 years old. Frogs are strange creatures. One would describe them as peculiarly wary and timid, another as equally bold and imperturbable. All that is required in studying them is patience. You will sometimes walk a long way along a ditch and hear 20 or more leap in one after another before you and see where they rippled the water without getting sight of one of them. You sit down on the brink and wait patiently for his reappearance. After a quarter of an hour or more, he is sure to rise to the surface and put out his nose quietly without making a ripple, eyeing you steadily. At length, he becomes as curious about you as you can be about him. He suddenly hops straight toward you, pausing within a foot, and takes a near and leisurely view of you. Perchance you may now scratch its nose with your finger and examine it to your heart's content, for it has become as imperturbable as it was shy before. You conquer them by superior patience and immovableness, not by quickness, but by slowness, not by heat, but by coldness. That's so gorgeous. And what an insight.
It's really amazing how he gets there, because at the end, he's not just talking about the frogs anymore. He's giving what seems to me a very deep kind of psychological account of how he's living his life, because it's everyone who calls him cold and immovable and stubborn. And so, you know, this is his response to the sort of Emerson criticism of him being, you know, a cold frog, right? That by coldness and by patience and by being stubborn and immovable, you get to befriend the frogs.
One last big theme about nature is his eye for color. He describes the color of everything. And he asks at some point, very simply, what is the color of the world?
Thoreau on color is one of the ways I got interested in the journals. I mean, I had known about them before. And this is, I think, two things. First of all, just his eye. And secondly, the fact that he is such a wordsmith and word nerd and really gets into trying to capture what it is that he sees on paper. Do you have any favorite color passages in mind?
Or February 1851, he's doing a little catalog. He says, "We love to see any part of the earth tinged with blue, cerulean, the color of the sky, the celestial color. Then we found the celandine in blossom." And he goes on talking about grays and red chokeberries of the swamp and the marsh marigold, thyme-leafed veronica, the little bluish white streak-petaled flower by roadsides. What is the orange-yellow aster-like flower of the meadows now in blossom? Then the delicate pinkish and yellowish flower with hoary green stems and leaves of rocky hills. It goes on indefinitely throughout the book. He stops and says, just what is that color? The red clover heads are now turned black, he writes at one point. But he's out there almost scientifically registering things.
Scientifically, but also lovingly. At the end of the journal, he says, he talks about how you never really get a picture from reading the naturalists, so the sort of scientific writing. And he says the reason why naturalists make so little account of color is because it is so insignificant to them. They do not understand it. But the lover of flowers or animals makes very much of color. To a fancier of cats, it is not indifferent whether one be black or gray, for the color expresses character.
Damien Searle, speak about Thoreau's politics. I mean, it's what people know through civil disobedience, for his non-payment of taxes, for his example to Gandhi and Gandhi to Martin Luther King, etc., of nonviolent resistance and all sort of stuff. In the journal, it strikes me that politics is kept at a distance. It sort of simmers there in the background. He has a great disdain for it. He says, I don't vote. I'll vote right here in my journal. And then suddenly, the Fugitive Slave Act, which empowered the federal government to take slaves back out of Massachusetts, so it brought it right into New England, and then John Brown bring this whole thing to a ferocious boil. That's a different Thoreau, it seems, that's writing about John Brown. Would you introduce that and maybe read from some of it?
Sure. I think you introduced it well. He's claimed politically probably most of all by the libertarians today. And you can see why, because what he wants from the political sphere is to be left alone to do his own thing. And on the other hand, he does arguably more than many of today's libertarians have a real social conscience and outrage about the things that governments do in his name. He doesn't want to be an American when the Americans are off in the Mexican-American War in a big land grab. He doesn't want to be an American when the Americans are holding millions of slaves, and actually does his part politically. He met John Brown personally. He gave John Brown money. And then when John Brown was arrested, he immediately went around to everyone in Concord and said, I'm going to be giving a speech on John Brown, you know, next week. And then when the local politicians were like, wait, is this the right thing to do? Isn't this a little bit of a bad time? He said, I wasn't asking your permission. I was just letting you know. John Brown for him was a hero who saw slavery for what it was and reacted to it the way one should react to it, in his view. Of course, it's complicated since technically you could call John Brown a terrorist and people could react to the guy who flew a plane into the IRS building a couple months ago with the same argument. So it's dicey territory. But in retrospect, of course, it's less dicey. We all know slavery was terrible and agitating against it is a good thing. And so he was certainly on the right side there. He helped escaped slaves on the Underground Railroad make it up to Canada. He did give abolitionist speeches with William Lloyd Garrison, including on the July 4th, where Garrison burned a copy of the Constitution. And it doesn't play as that big a role in the journal, except as a distraction from the life he'd rather be living.
But there are passages, Damien, in 1859 where he seems to be rehearsing speeches and laying out his lines. The John Brown crisis and slavery has finally made a kind of radical Christian of him. He says, a government that pretends to be Christian and crucifies a million Christs every day.
This is October 19th, 1859. It galls me to listen to the remarks of craven-hearted neighbors who speak disparagingly of John Brown because he resorted to violence, resisted the government, threw his life away. What way have they thrown their lives? In the full journals that this is abridged from, there's about 40 or 50 pages on John Brown. And you're right, this is a lot of it is kind of drafting or note-taking for the speeches on John Brown that he was going to give. That's one reason why I felt okay about trimming it down to a few pages in this edition, because a lot of the other material in the journal just flowed into the speeches that he gave. But it absolutely occupied him, both in 1859, and in fact, one reason he died is because the bronchitis that he caught in December of 1860, which sort of developed into what killed him, he was up late arguing about John Brown on the anniversary of Brown's execution. So instead of recovering from this cold, which developed into the illness that killed him, he stayed up all night arguing about John Brown. So you're right. It definitely was too important to him to be shunted aside and for him to go on these walks. He says things like, you know, what if you have a nice library and you suddenly realize that it's located in hell?
Mm.
It sort of takes away your enjoyment of the books. You know, that's sort of how he felt to be living in those times and trying to do what he ultimately wanted to do.
I think this is very challenging, actually, to the commonplaces of Tea Party America in 2010. This is a man who's aflame morally. At one point in the journal, he writes, some 1,800 years ago, Christ was crucified. This morning, perhaps, John Brown was hung. These are the two ends of a chain which I rejoice to know is not without its links. At the same time, this is a guy who has no use for the federal government, for taxes, for most of what's done in the name of the law. He says why the United States government never performed an act of justice in its life. That is an extreme teabag position.
Absolutely. As with so many of Thoreau's positions, if you take it as seriously as he means it, you end up pretty quickly in uncomfortable territory.
I think Thoreau would be desperately uncomfortable with things done in the name of the law and his tax money today, including, to my taste, predator drones in Afghanistan. But so many, many things. I think he'd be horrified by the fetters on an individual in the woods today.
Absolutely. He was with the Mexican-American War, with slavery. There's no question.
Damien Soares, we've got to talk about Thoreau the stylist. And it fascinates me that a young stylist like you, and we've not talked enough about your incredibly original work, but that finds this man a model in his prose too.
That's the great joy of these journals. This is a guy who loved to sit there with a pen in his hand and a blank sheet of paper in front of him. And that is ultimately, in my view, really central to understanding, you know, what Thoreau's about and to enjoying the journal. I just wanted it to be a book that you could read because the writing is so great.
It's a book I'm never going to stop reading, but let's stick with it. He, of course, was a postage stamp in the 1960s. He was a hero in that kind of turbulent decade. But it's fascinating to me even more that for writers born in the 60s and 70s like you and David Shields and maybe Dave Eggers and lots of others, there's some stylistic affinity here.
Yeah, I wonder about that myself. I had three projects that were going to come out at the same time, except the others have ended up being delayed. So one was this edition of Thoreau's journal. The other was a similar sort of selection from a huge body of work by Rainer Maria Rilke, which is out this month. And then a book called On Reading by Proust. So they were all going to come out at the same time. And in my mind, they go together. And you usually would not think of Thoreau, Rilke, and Proust as a trio. But they have more in common than you'd think. Proust himself was a disciple of Emerson's. His first book is dotted with Emerson epigraphs all over the place. It's kind of staggering to think about. But at one point, he planned to translate Walden into French. Wouldn't that have been something? When he read excerpts of Walden in another translation, he praised them in a letter to his friend by saying, it is as though one were reading them inside oneself. So much do they arise from the depths of our intimate experience. And that's such a great Proustian bit of praise. That's what Proust is always looking for. But it really lets you see, I mean, I think of Proust's Cork-lined Room and Thoreau's Cabin in Walden as the two iconic places where a writer burrowed into himself in solitude and got to a place that spoke incredibly intimately to his readers. I mean, that's the kind of Emerson project of becoming self-reliant, and that's when you become universal. And Thoreau and Proust, which is a strange combination, but I think it's really right. I mean, Remembrance of Things Past is one of the only books nearly as long as Thoreau's journal. They're the ones who really did it. And then Rilke is such an aesthete, but it's kind of remarkable how many of these Thoreau journals end up sounding like Rilke poems in prose or vice versa. I think that in terms of the generational stuff, it took a while. Thoreau was seen as this kind of crusty Yankee, and then he was seen as this civil disobedience hero and this environmental prophet, all of which are true. There's a book called Senses of Walden by the great philosopher Stanley Cavell in the early 70s that started to really read Thoreau's writing as this very dense, literary, connective, pun-filled, textured thing of greatness that it is. So I think it's only been recently in the 70s and 80s and 90s that people have paid as much attention to Thoreau's prose as I think it deserves.
Well said, Damien. I never connected the cabin in Concord with the cork-lined parlor in Paris, but that's brilliant. Coming back to David Shields, though, and Reality Hunger, David talks about the aphoristic, the explosive, the wild, the impetuous in writing. And here's this passage from Thoreau's journal in November 1850. He says, and this is connecting the wilderness and his own prose, or the prose he loves. In literature, it is only the wild that attracts us. Dullness is only another name for tameness. It is the untamed, uncivilized, free, and wild thinking in Hamlet, in the Iliad, and in all the scriptures and mythologies that delights us, not learned in the schools, not refined and polished by art. A truly good book is something as wildly natural and primitive, mysterious and marvelous, ambrosial and fertile as a fungus or a lichen. Suppose the muskrat or beaver were to turn his views to literature, what fresh views of nature would he present? The fault of our books and our other deeds is that they are too humane. I want something speaking in some measure to the condition of muskrats and skunk cabbage, as well as of men, not merely to a pining and complaining coterie of philanthropists.
It's great how he gets those kind of long Latinate words at the end to complain about the kind of people they are. Muskrats and skunk cabbage. So all those K's, all those U's, all those hard sounds, not merely to a pining and complaining coterie of philanthropists, these long words. He at one point talks about words like that as dragging their tails after them. But when you were saying about in literature, it's only the wild that attracts us and the aphoristic David Shields stuff, when I listen to you read a passage like the one you just read, it doesn't sound like Emerson. And why doesn't it sound like Emerson? Because Emerson is the famous, you know, pearls on a string. Each of these sentences is this aphoristic, isolated gem. And then it's followed by another one. I feel like Thoreau is this reviser and connector and synthesizer. In a way, he doesn't produce aphorisms except the aphorisms that grow out of this rich mulch of all these details and facts that he has. All of his aphorisms are metaphors or connections. The bluebird carries the sky on its back. So what is that? That's this kind of visual rhyme between two blue things, as well as sort of reversing. You usually say spring brings the birds. But he's saying, no, the birds bring spring too. Why are you saying that the birds are just the effect and not the cause? And it's this way also of expressing how ecstatic he is that finally spring is here again in New England. You know, New England winters are long and they're brutal, and now there's a bluebird, and his heart just leaps. And so by saying that the leaping of the bluebird is like the whole sky, it brings all this energy and joy into this thing he's describing. So sure, it's an aphorism, but it's always one that's trying to bridge different levels. And that's what makes the writing so powerful and transporting. It's always taking you somewhere.
I enjoy your contrast with Emerson. I know Emerson better than Thoreau, but I love the evidences in the Journal of the Tension, or Thoreau's version of it. He refers at some point to Emerson being nobility, I'm a commoner, which mm-hmm. isn't quite true. But I love this. He said Bronson Alcott had gone to see Emerson yesterday, came to see me today. Alcott had got his wine, and now he had come after his venison. Such was the compliment he paid to me. Emerson's wine, I'm red meat.
And like gamey red meat, too.
Yeah. There's another beautiful contrast, something Thoreau writes that Emerson wouldn't have. Thoreau, loving outdoor work, work with his hands, cutting wood, lifting rocks, whatever. He says, I find incessant labor with the hands, which engrosses the attention also, the best method to remove palaver out of one's style. Working man's prose.
That's one of the things that he's so great and inspiring for as a young writer. He talks about how he wishes he could just go to the store and buy a magic eraser that would get rid of all the stuff that he needs to cut from his draft, but he just can't bring himself to do it. And eventually when he does it, the book is better, but it's so painful. And he wishes he could just get the like special kind of eraser that'll erase only those sentences.
Have you ever considered who was the 20th century Henry David Thoreau, who might be the 21st? And we're talking about a complex of prose power, moral energy, and this sort of rootedness in nature.
You know, one person that comes to my mind would be David Foster Wallace for a few reasons. The energy of the prose and the sense that every word, every syllable has been thought through and dug out and expresses his character. The way in which he is such an inspiration to other authors and is this sort of monumental voice that other people can't capture but can admire and can sort of strive towards. I think that David Foster Wallace was as committed to plunging into everything about life today, socially, technologically, historically, as Thoreau was committed to plunging into everything in the ecology of his surroundings, and really committed to seeing how it all connects and finding a kind of prose voice that let him really see these relationships or express these relationships that he saw. So he's who comes to my mind, although, you know, I don't know that he was as much of a naturalist. I think Wallace was more interested in the kind of social universe or ecology.
I was just thinking that E.O. Wilson, the ant biologist, but by now novelist, is not quite the stylist that David Foster Wallace and Henry David Thoreau were, but he's a scientist at another level entirely, and he remains concerned about the whole, about species and humanity and the habitat. I think he's out there. Damien Sirs, you speak about the crank, the misanthrope in Thoreau, but there are also flashes in this book of people he really, really likes. And I'm not talking about Emerson or his equal, so to speak, but there's a farmer, Minot, that he really admires, tasty, serious farmer. And there's this woman, Mary Emerson. I presume that's Mary Moody Emerson, Emerson's aunt?
It is.
Who he just adores. She's a genius. She's a conversationalist. She's interested in everything. Dwell on those kinds of people that he loved.
He was certainly not a misanthrope in the sense that he wanted to dislike people or came to people assuming that they were unlikable. I think he was more of a romantic who had these impossibly high expectations of people and was constantly disappointed and very saddened by the fact that he didn't have a soulmate romantically. He didn't have a true friend he could really commune with on this level that he told himself he wanted to commune on and things like that. So I think he's very happy to meet people he can talk to. And those tend to be either Mary Emerson, someone who's very nonconformist and tells it like it is and blunt and direct, and a lot of the sort of fellow townsmen and farmers and people like that who he becomes friends with are similarly people who, you know, he can just this kind of very blunt and direct and authentic connection. You quoted earlier the passage about wildness in writing, and that's just what he valued about people too. He wanted people to be real, to be authentic and direct, and not to be doing things because it's because of manners or because of social constraints or because of conformity. But I think that he was thrilled whenever he found someone who was willing to, you know, relate to him on that level.
Damien, I'd love you to read a couple more of your favorites and introduce themes that I haven't mentioned.
Sure. So we were talking before about how Thoreau loves all these things so much that he animates them. One of my absolute favorite passages in the journal is from September 28th, 1857. I planted 6 seeds sent from the patent office and labeled, I think, Poitrine Jaune Grosse. Large yellow pumpkin or squash, he gives a tentative translation. 2 came up. One bore a squash which weighs 123.5 pounds. The other bore 4. One weighing 72¾, second weighing 54, third weighing 37¾, fourth weighing 21¾. And he draws a line and adds it all up, 309¾ pounds. Who would have believed that there were 310 pounds of Poitrine Jaune Grosse in that corner of our garden, yet that little seed found it? I think that's so moving to imagine this seed going out and finding all the squash, all the 310 pounds of squash in that little plot of soil, which in a way is not what seeds do, right? There wasn't 310 pounds of squash sitting there waiting to be found. But in another way, it is what seeds do. It was in the form of soil, but it was 310 pounds of squash, and that little seed sent out its roots and found it. It's so beautiful. You feel such a sense of identification and friendship with this heroic little seed that's pulled off this great task. I mean, it was in a packet, and now it's 310 pounds of squash. I love that part. Let's see. Another theme I'd like to mention, which we've touched on a bit before, is that this book is really a very fascinating psychological exploration.
Yes.
He starts off as a earnest young man who's very committed to habit and character, and you practice things and then you become the kind of person who makes a certain observation or writes a certain sentence. He says that over and over again, that to write the kind of sentence he wants to read, you have to be the kind of person who writes that sentence. Mm. What a sentence does is express your character, who you are. That's why he likes these farmers who have more insightful things to say about their fields than any scientist who has more information about it, but who has less life experience with it. And as his life goes on, he sort of deepens and modifies this and begins to allow a kind of greater role for not so much kind of Puritan, Protestant, Yankee hard work and make yourself into the kind of person, blah, 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 but moods and sort of influences from without. And part of what makes you who you are isn't your hard work in training yourself, but just these ephemeral environmental forces that act on you. here's a passage that I really like from March 11th, 1859. And so I will skip a bunch of the entry here. He's talking about a house that sort of burned down, and there's all these dates and kind of things scribbled on the walls that are now visible and stuff like that. And then his uncle has just died, and so another villager is telling him a story about it. Large flocks of blackbirds today in the elm tops. Then he says, find out as soon as possible what are the best things in your composition, then shape the rest to fit them. The former will be the midrib and veins of the leaf. Mm. And then he says, there's always some accident in the best things, whether thoughts or expressions or deeds. The memorable thought, the happy expression, the admirable deed are only partly ours. The thought came to us because we were in a fit mood. Also, we were unconscious and did not know that we had said or done a good thing. We must walk consciously only partway toward our goal and then leap in the dark to our success. What we do best or most perfectly is what we have most thoroughly learned by the longest practice, and at length it falls from us without our notice, as a leaf from a tree. It is the last time we shall do it, our unconscious leavings.
Wow, that's deep. What we do best or most perfectly is what we have most thoroughly learned by the longest practice, and at length it falls from us without our notice, as a leaf from a tree. That's gorgeous.
And it partly comes from the previous paragraph, right, about the midrib and veins of the leaf. With the longer entries, the parts really do fit together in this very mysterious way. Isn't it so zen? I mean, the idea that it's when you forget the target that you hit it or whatever. But the unconscious leavings, one of these great, great Thoreau puns. Puns were very important to him because they were an especially compressed way of expressing connections. So it's the things you leave behind. But that's what a leaf is. You know, it's left. It's a leaving. So the leaf falling from the tree is leaving the tree. And these unconscious leavings that you have to walk consciously only partway toward our goal. That's a difference between the later Thoreau and the early Thoreau. The early Thoreau would say you have to reach your goal and train yourself to be that kind of person. But the more mature age 41 Thoreau says you walk partway and then leap in the dark to our success.
Damien Searles, thank you. The Journal of Henry David Thoreau, 1837 to 1861, in a new abridgment, published by New York Review Books. Thank you, Damien. We'll talk again.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.